Welcome to 2819. I'm Sandra Dimas.
And I'm Brian Rollenbacher.
And it's our spooky Halloween episode. Okay, it's not really spooky.
Yeah, we're definitely not spooky here.
But we're talking about Halloween, among other things.
That's right. Well, we have RTB 101, and we're going to be hearing from author Jason Thacker about ethics in the age of AI.
And in Give and Take, Jeff Swerenk will be chatting with biochemist Fuzzel Rana about Krebs cycle design. We'll find out what that is in a little bit.
I have no clue, so it's going to be a good segment. I'm going to learn at least one thing. First up is Culture Talk, and this is where we're going to get spooky, according to Sandra. Her and theologian Ken Samples will be discussing the pagan origins of Halloween. It's going to be great, so let's check it out.
Now it's time for Culture Talk, the segment where we talk about culturally relevant topics that you can use to start conversations about your faith. And I'm joined today with philosopher and theologian Ken Samples. Thank you for joining us.
Hello.
We're going to be talking about the tricky topic of Halloween.
Yes.
Specifically, its pagan origin. So, you know, we want to be very respectful of others when we talk about topics like Halloween that maybe some are cool with and some see issues with it.
Sure.
One of the issues that people might have is that Halloween is connected to a form of paganism. So can you dive into that?
Yeah, well, there's truth to that. Mm-hmm. There is a harvest festival, the beginning of winter, called Samhain. Mm-hmm. And that kind of celebrated the cycle of life and death. Mm-hmm. And so that was celebrated on or about October 31st. Mm-hmm. So you definitely have a connection to a festival that would have been celebrated by non-Christians.
Yeah. And what were some of the activities that were done in this festival that maybe have transferred over to Halloween?
Yeah, they would carve, they would bob for apples, mm-hmm. and carve various vegetables and fruits. Mm-hmm. There would be a connection to, again, the cycle of death and the spirit that would pass on to the next life. So it's definitely connected to, death and the afterlife.
Okay, so things like, well, bobbing for apples, that's not COVID safe, so probably don't do that anyway. But like carving pumpkins, which is what we do, some of us do for Halloween, some Christians would feel like because of its pagan origins, Halloween shouldn't be dabbled with at all.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that?
Two topics there, two issues for me. Mm-hmm. Number one, I think you want to be very careful about judging or evaluating something totally in terms of its origin. Here's an example. The very first astronomers were all astrologers. Mm-hmm. But the issue is astronomy evolved and changed. It wasn't merely a connection to the stars, but it became a scientific discipline. With Halloween, there is a pagan origin, but very quickly Christianity began to influence even the Halloween practices. Mm-hmm. I mean, the day after Halloween is All Saints' Day, mm-hmm. and Christians were looking to communicate, not change the culture, but maybe change the focus and orientation of the holidays.
Right, and I think that's an important distinction because things don't stay the same, they evolve. And so Halloween has evolved to this, depending on how one engages in it, it can be fairly tame where it's, getting candy and dressing up in things that aren't gory or horrific.
Right.
So what would be your input there when people feel like Christians really shouldn't even do trick-or-treating or anything?
I think that we want to think carefully about the decisions we make. On one hand, there are people who engage in what I would call, the horrific elements of death and things like that. And I think there are times where Halloween, goes overboard. Mm-hmm. And so some Christians are going to definitely feel uncomfortable with that. On the other hand, I mean, kids dressing up in funny and spooky outfits and then collecting candy. Mm-hmm. I mean, for my kids, Halloween was just this far under Christmas. They weren't going to miss it. I think if you decide as a Christian not to let your kids go trick-or-treating, and that's your decision, mm-hmm. I want to guard against our kids growing up with a party pooper view of God. Mm. I honestly, when I was in the third grade, we had a Christmas party at school, and the Jehovah's Witnesses in the class, they had to go and sit in the corner. Now, I didn't know a lot of the differences between my Catholicism and their Watchtower views, but I knew I don't want to hold that religion.
Yeah.
I think take your kids to a harvest party at church, make sure there's a lot of candy there, give them an opportunity to have fun. And again, I think it's a choice for the parent. I let my kids go trick-or-treating.
Right.
But, it wasn't a radical approach to Halloween in my neighborhood.
Right. And I think that it's important to, like, as you're demonstrating, to just be fair and respectful that it's a decision. So whether one is Jehovah's Witness and they decide that they are not going to participate in anything of that nature, or they're a Christian and they're like, yeah, we can go trick-or-treating, that we're respectful of each other and the decisions that we've made. I want to tap into another question. So we're talking about pagan origins of Halloween. Is it fair then to say if we toss out Halloween, then how do we then look at Christmas and look at Easter, which are also tied or have pagan origins?
I think that's right. And I think what the church did, this is the historic Christian church, They didn't stop all of the celebration. Mm-hmm. They tried to change the focus. Mm-hmm. Instead of Halloween being about death, it was all the saints that would rise in the in the next life. Christmas, instead of, again, solstice and those issues, it was about the birth of the Messiah who came into history. So I think the church was trying to give us a wholesome way of looking at these types of issues. And quite frankly, I think they were very wise to do what they did.
I think so too. I think it's a parenting tactic
in
a sense, because we can tell our child no, and okay, that's one way. Another way is to like divert their attention to something. If they're doing something that isn't safe or isn't wise, how can we divert their attention to something and put their energy elsewhere? And so I think that's kind of what the church maybe took a parental role in shifting focus to Christ and to the Christian calendar, so to speak.
We have a lot to learn from church history.
Right. No, and I appreciate what you are doing to educate people on church history and our church fathers and Orthodox belief. So one last question. Yep. I think it's a crucial one. What is your favorite Halloween candy?
Well, there's something magical and mysterious about chocolate and peanut butter coming together. Mm-hmm. And I like that come together as well. So Reese's would be probably at the top of the list for
me. Add a third and you've got a trinity of candy.
I'm working on that.
I know you're a big fan of the trinity. Well, thank you so much for that, Ken.
Sure.
So if people want to learn more about this topic, what would you recommend?
Well, I have an article entitled The Tricky Topic of Halloween, where we kind of work through these types of issues in there. So I think that would be a good first step.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Ken. So again, if you would like to hear more on this topic, go to reasons.org and search for The Tricky Topic of Halloween.
As technology continues to impact and affect every area of our life, we cannot depend on vague generalities to make these ethical decisions. Our dignity and that of our neighbors is at stake. Take, for example, the first of the recent Google AI principles, what's deemed as be socially beneficial. This sounds like a laudable goal and something that we could all support. But if you take a really deep look at what they mean by that, it's incredibly ambiguous. What does it mean to be beneficial? What if my definition of beneficial is different than yours? Who is it going to benefit, the majority or the minority? Who decides? Who decides who decides? As you read these explanations, it becomes clear that there's a subtle form of utilitarianism actually framing this ethic. And I quote from that first principle, as we consider the potential development and uses of AI technologies, we have to take into account the broad range of social and economic factors, and we will proceed from there when we believe that the overall likely benefits substantially exceed the foreseeable risk and downsides. It's clear what Google is saying here is that they are going to pursue what brings about the most good, even though that good is often left undefined and vague. But as we all know, every person exhibits some type of bias or discrimination in the ways due to our sinfulness and our pride, and that can spill over into our ethics. And while Google has every right to pursue this course of action as they develop these powerful AI technologies, the public also has a right to push back on these vague utilitarian arguments and seek clarity about how these potentially life-altering technologies will be developed and used. And the Google AI principles are actually released on the heels of this infamous Project Maven project that they were working on with the military. They partnered with the United States Department of Defense to help develop an AI system that could help comb through countless hours of drone data, video data. The AI system was being trained to identify and automatically label targets and objects within the video data. Google actually pulled out of the project due to an uproar from their own employees who thought that Google shouldn't be involved in the weapons or tools of war, and that these technologies must be employed in a fair and socially beneficial way. The irony here is that this type of partnership between technology firms and the military actually allowed them their right to protest in a free society. But these protests raise many questions, though. What is the good? What is right? What is moral in these situations? How does fairness in this context line up with our safety of our brothers and sisters on the battlefield? What is fair and socially beneficial about terrorists or rogue nations having the advantage on the battlefield? Without clarity on the details of these ethical principles, it becomes increasingly difficult for our society to think wisely about the roles and the power of these technologies. As technology gets folded into nearly every aspect of our life, it's nearly impossible to avoid these conflicts between what is true and what we want to be true. What if the church had a better way forward, one that brought light to darkness and clarity to the murkiness of our ethical decisions? As Christians, our ethical decision-making cannot be tied to the prevailing attitudes of certain elites or the in-crowd or what's called the right side of history. At the most basic level, a Christian ethic is a transcendent or revealed morality. Not only did God create each of us in his image or in his likeness that we read about in Genesis, but he also spoke to us and he revealed to us how we are to live as his image bearers. Jesus Christ himself summed up the entirety of the Christian ethic in Matthew 22, verses 37 through 39, where he said that the greatest commandment was to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. And the second was to love your neighbor as yourself. To quote the esteemed theologian in Ephesus, Carl F. H. Henry, love for another is the whole sum of the Christian ethic. Henry goes on to say that God first loving us is a summary of Christian doctrine, and us loving him is the summary of Christian morality. Now, while this might seem simplistic, especially given the immense ethical challenges that we spoke about earlier, this simple yet profoundly robust ethic is more than capable of helping us to face some of the most complex and challenging questions being posed by artificial intelligence with a hope and a resolute faith in our God as our creator. Naturally, in Christian ethics, there's questions that are being raised about what does it mean to love God and what does it mean to actually love our neighbor? Simply put, to love God is to follow his commandments. This is what we read about in 1 John 5:3. It means sacrificing our sinful desires and pursuits as we seek to love God more than we love ourselves and to love those whom God loves as we obey his commandments and follow after him. It means for us to be who God created us to be, to live in the way in which he designed us to live, and to honor the dignity and value of every human being as a fellow image bearer of God. And by loving others and putting others before ourselves, we will take a very distinct view of ethics and technology, especially with AI, that can be so easily used to dehumanize our neighbors and treat them as simply a means to an end or a means to self-preservation, power, and control. As we saw earlier about the rise of facial recognition, automation, even weapons of war, it's easier than ever to dehumanize or subjugate our neighbors as we, in a bit of irony, seek to humanize our own machines. In this age of AI, the Christian ethic calls us to live in a certain way that reflects the goodness of our Creator and our love for our neighbor. It reminds us that while we are still each individuals with an interior nature, this isn't to be exposed for everyone to see, even though we don't have a true sense of privacy before our God. Our God is all-knowing, but he's also all-loving. And that standard of all-knowing and all-loving is something that our fellow man often fails to live up to because of our sinful natures. The Christian ethic reminds us that while there is some kind of value in our contributions to society, our work does not define us as human beings. We're created to work in God's good design, even if our work might look different than expected in the light of artificial intelligence and the technologies of the future. A Christian ethic also helps to remind us that even though our enemies, we seek justice in this world, we also bear the weight of responsibility because our enemies too are also created in God's image, and we must seek justice as we seek just war in our combat. And even as machines and AI might subtly shift how we go about seeking justice and peace, our role as image bearers and the call to love our neighbor does not change. So as we debate the dangers and the merits of emerging technologies like the cost of facial recognition systems, or how algorithmic biases disparage minorities, or how AI-based weapon systems are being deployed in our battlefield, we must remember that we're called to apply this robust Christian framework of ethics centered on the dignity of every human being to every single area of our decision-making and our moral decision-making. The Christian moral tradition is based on this concept of human exceptionalism, which runs contrary to many of the materialistic type of visions that are so prevalent in science and technology. And this is why we must keep human dignity at the core of our ethical framework. Who are we to claim that God, the creator of the cosmos and the universe, who knit us together in our mother's womb, doesn't actually understand what is good for us and what ultimately will lead to his glory? We're called to love our neighbors, to stand up for their rights and the dignity in an incredibly complex world. As technology and influence increases in our society, we must be reminded that we have a steadfast hope and a robust ethic to engage the issues of the day from a place of hope and faith, rather than this debilitating pessimism or even this unbridled optimism. Christians have a steady hope in the midst of an uncertain future because we know that our God is above all sovereign over history, and that all of humanity, and that nothing will ever change or supplant the image of God that God has created us in him.
Hello, Jeff Zwerink. Welcome back to Give and Take, the segment of our show where we explore important scientific ideas and see how they relate to the truth of Christianity. Today, I'm joined by my friend and colleague, Dr. Fuzz Rana, and we're going to talk about the Krebs cycle. Fuzz, good to have you here today.
Jeff, thanks for having me.
So I'll be honest, the Krebs cycle is one of those things that I remember hearing about in my biology class. I know it's got a lot of complicated chemistry in it, but I'd kind of like to just start off today, kind of tell us, what is the Krebs cycle and what role does it play in life, if you will?
Yeah, well, you know, in my opinion, the Krebs cycle is probably one of the most important metabolic pathways inside the cell. In fact, it's more or less universally located in the cells of all living organisms. And it's part of what biochemists call intermediary metabolism. And for a biochemist, metabolism refers to the sum total of all the chemical reactions that are taking place inside the cell. And there's a subset of those reactions that are called intermediary metabolic pathways. And these pathways are used to break down compounds so energy can be liberated to power the cell's operation. They are also used to build the building block materials that would make things like proteins and fatty acids and sugars and in nucleobases and things like that. And so they're very important pathways. And these pathways typically are organized by a sequence of chemical reactions where the starting compound undergoes small successive modifications till it produces the final product, where each step is mediated by what biochemists call an enzyme that facilitates that transformation. And the pathways can be linear, they can be branched, they can be circular. The Krebs cycle is a circular pathway. And some of the pathways actually interconnect with one another. So when you look at the metabolic chart, it looks like a roadmap for a very large city where the pathways are like the roadway system in that city. But the Krebs cycle sits right at the center of all of intermediary metabolism. It's part of what biochemists call central carbon metabolism, where it takes the breakdown products of glucose and breaks them down further into CO2 and water and uses that energy to power most of the cell's operations, but also the intermediates in that cyclical pathway can be siphoned off and used to make amino acids and nucleobases and fats and sugars. So it's a core metabolic pathway that really resides at the very heart of intermediary metabolism and really the heart of biochemistry.
So it really does strike me as this is a very important aspect of all life. Because I mean, you know, my vision of the cell is there's kind of these little groups of things, but all of the chemical interactions, it seems like they ultimately are anchored onto this Krebs cycle, if you will. Either they use a product of or they're part of the link. It really seems very central to life here on Earth. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's central. And again, it's universally distributed among life forms. Every organism is made up of one or more cells, and all of those cells have a Krebs cycle, a version of the Krebs cycle in them. And because of its central importance, you know, many people that study the origin of life question think that if they can understand how the Krebs cycle could have emerged, through chemical evolution, that they can gain insight into the origin of life question.
So this does seem to have origin of life ties in. So are you saying in looking at the origin of life, they're looking at somehow this cycle may have been set up outside the cell and then incorporated into the cell? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes. Yeah. That class of explanations is called metabolism first pathways, where metabolic reactions would have emerged as autocatalytic cycles that then later became encapsulated in kind of in protocellular systems, encapsulated within membrane systems. But what's interesting is that...
Hold on. Given the complexity, that seems a little bit bizarre that this complex set of interactions would happen somewhere out in the environment. I mean, is there evidence that this happened on the early Earth or when life was forming?
Yeah. Well, there actually is, because, for example, in the early 2000s, the late Harold Morowitz, who when he was alive was a very prominent origin of life researcher, actually determined that the components of the Krebs cycle, the intermediates that are part of the Krebs cycle, have a really unusual set of chemical properties that make them very likely to form under the conditions of the early Earth and persist, that they have this just right set of properties that make them inherent in prebiotic chemistry, that they would be a natural outworking of prebiotic reactions. And then more recently, two independent teams of researchers have shown that you can start with a chemical compound called glyoxylate or pyruvate, and through very simple reactions in the lab, generate all of the Krebs cycle intermediates. And in fact, the sequence in which you generate those Krebs cycle intermediates is the sequence in which they appear in the Krebs cycle pathway. And so it looks as if it's very easy under the conditions of the early Earth to make these Krebs cycle intermediates. And again, these compounds that are part of this pathway have a really unusual and just right set of properties that make them conducive to forming and persisting under the conditions of the early Earth.
So the fact that this very complex, very important chemical cycle, this pathway, this Krebs cycle, seems to almost be naturally flow out of the early Earth chemistry, that seems to lend credence to an origin of life, or to a naturalistic or an evolutionary origin of life scenario. But I think you actually argue it points to a creator. How do you draw that contrast there?
Yeah. And to be clear, Jeff, you and I are skeptics of at least aspects of the evolutionary paradigm. I'm skeptical that chemical evolution in an unguided sense could ever produce a cell starting with simple chemical molecules. But let's say for the sake of argument that you assume or you adopt the view that chemical evolution is the way to explain the origin of life. What this is telling us is that these Krebs cycle intermediates didn't just simply emerge through chance as a part of a historically contingent evolutionary process, but rather they seem to be fundamentally prescribed by the very laws of nature, that the conditions of the early Earth were just right to support carbon chemistry, and that carbon chemistry has the just right set of properties to produce these Krebs cycle intermediates that have a just right set of properties for prebiotic chemistry, but also have the just right set of properties for them to function as the central hub for metabolism. So it's a series of coincidences that are all stacked on top of each other that are highly suspicious, that suggest that there seems to be some intentionality and purpose that undergirds even prebiotic chemistry. And that to me, you know, suggests there's maybe a mind that has jimmy-rigged everything at the very beginning so that life is possible. So in other words, whether you adopt the view that we hold where God is intervening to bring about the origin of life in a direct way, or you adopt an evolutionary view, you can't escape the fact that at minimum, a creator must have jimmy-rigged everything for life to be possible and probably intervened to bring it about.
You know, it's remarkable because what you're talking about sounds a lot like what I see from Fred Hoyle as he's looking at how carbon is produced in stars, that he sees these remarkable coincidences that if they were not that way, we wouldn't get life. In fact, his kind of conclusion was a super intellect monkeyed with physics. It seems like that's what you're arguing here, correct?
That's exactly right. And I really appreciate you drawing to Fred Hoyle in what is known as the anthropic principle, you know, in cosmology, you know, that everything has to be just right for life to be possible. And we see that same, you know, set of just right conditions that are needed, interestingly enough, even for the prebiotic chemistry needed for the Krebs cycle.
Well, thanks very much, Fuzz. I appreciate your comments. You know, when we look at the universe, it is remarkable that we can explain and understand and describe so much of the universe. And what Fuzz has brought to us here today is this recognition that it seems like physics and chemistry are designed or put together in such a way that this important component of life, the Krebs cycle, flows out of the conditions of the early Earth. It really does point towards a mind or a creator. You know, I would encourage you to go to reasons.org and check out Fuzz's blog on this. It's called Krebs Cycle Origin Brings Case for Creation Full Circle. Gives you a lot of biochemical details on what's going on, but more importantly than that, helps you see the big picture and how, as we study and know more about creation, we find more evidence to point people towards the creator behind it all.
That does it for us this week on 2019. We hope you enjoyed this episode and that it helped equip you to share your faith with confidence and compassion.
And don't forget to subscribe to the show and search for us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are at 2819 Show. We'd love to hear your thoughts. And hey, if you're celebrating Halloween, what are you going to dress up as?
I love dressing up.
Yes.
Even when it's not Halloween.
Me too.
So anyway, if you're dressing up, like, post a picture because I definitely want to see that. Also, if you like the audio version of 2819, we're on most major podcast services. Just search Reasons to Believe Podcast.
See you next week.
Bye.